Hello, everybody, and welcome to Mind Clickers. I'm a sport and exercise scientist from Melbourne, Australia, with a passion for esports performance, coaching, and overall mental well-being. I've been in esports for quite my life, previously competing in COD 4 Pro Mod and coaching StarCraft 2, whilst avidly loving CSGO and all FPSs. I created Mind Clickers to provide an insight into the psychological and performance demands of elite-level gaming. This includes getting an insight from coaches, players, staff, org founders, and esports researchers about their respective domains. In the following episode, I chat with Zach Rusty Pyre, an Australian esports commentator and personal trainer. He is a former League of Legends LPL caster, head coach, and pro player. Zach has recently been busy casting the League of Legends circuit Oceania. Zach and I chat about his experience as a head coach and pro player, alongside the League of Legends OCE scene, tilting, mental toughness, team dynamics, exercise science, and his experience living in China for 1 year shoutcasting. I really enjoyed having a chat with Zach, as I was able to further understand more about the League of Legends OCE scene, a scene that I engaged in my very early esports years. I hope all listeners can take away a couple of key points that can be extrapolated into their own game or into their own coach's game as well. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Mind Clickers, where it's time to click both heads in 2021. I'm joined today by Zach Rusty Pye, who is an Aussie esports commentator, currently casting for the LCO and current personal trainer, alongside being a former international caster, head coach, and pro player in League of Legends. How are you going today, mate?
Yeah, fantastic. It's a bit wet out here, so if you hear rain, I apologize, but yeah, definitely ready to get into this conversation.
That's all right, no worries. Thanks for joining me today, first and foremost. I'm glad that we found the time to organize something and we can jump on and kind of extrapolate all between your previous experiences and your current experiences as a caster as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think like when you reached out to me on the conversation that you want to have, it did kind of hit home with me. So I'm definitely interested in just having this conversation with more people. So this is, you know, the perfect idea.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely think that in regards to OCE, the esports performance scene, has been developing within recent years. So it's only good to just get in there to extrapolate more ideas, more insights, because that just helps to bring home for the lower guys in, you know, the lower tiers as well, to help give them motivation to push into the higher tiers as well, I think.
100%, yeah. And I mean, it ebbs and flows in terms of availability, awareness, you know, resources. So I think the more you can get the word out there and more you can make it known, the better it'll be.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Before we get into it, biggest question in OC at the moment is, are you getting an Amumu tattoo or not?
So the deal is, if there is an Amumu picked before the split ends, I will get an Amumu tattoo. I already have a barred one, so it'll just go alongside that. Yeah. So it'll fit in. Like, I won't be upset about the fact that I've got it there. But so far, no Amumus and no tattoos. So I think I'm safe for now.
Oh, all right. We'll see how the picks go further on. I guess let's just get into it. So a little bit about yourself, your previous experience within League and, you know, stuff you're doing external to League and, you know, esports as well.
Yeah. So I've been involved in esports and League of Legends specifically for about 10 years now. I'm getting closer to the 11 mark, I think. I originally started as a pro player in 2010. That was something that took me internationally. I was part of the first team from Oceania to ever go internationally for League, which was really cool. We went to Busan, Korea. We got smacked around by some of the other teams over there, but that was just the way it was. And I can't say that's changed much. From there, I just continued to play until about 2014. I had a career where I was mostly second place a lot of the time. But there were some absolute monsters that came through after the Korean tournament. I stopped playing in 2014 towards the end of the year and started studying to be a primary teacher, started working full-time as a bartender. I completely exited for like a three-month period maybe. And then I got a message from a friend who was working as a commentator. He's like, do you want to have a shot? We're hiring. So I took the shot, I applied and went through the interviews and managed to get there. And here I am still, you know, 6 years later, roughly, continuing to shoutcast. And of course, there was some stuff in between, right? Like I haven't just shoutcasted the whole time. I've been lucky enough to work on different products in different countries. You know, I got to live in China for a year as well doing this, which was phenomenal. And I've also done coaching work when I came back from China for a full year. So really trying to do what I can out there in the world. And that kind of led me to the idea of wanting to also be a personal trainer, right? Mm. I've spent so long now in esports, and I feel like I matured through while being a part of it. That you start to quickly notice that, you know, as you get older, you can't just be a 17-year-old hunched at a computer for 15 hours a day and expect to be healthy 10 years later. So I copped that, and that really, you know, switched it on for me.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess having that previous experience as a coach, it kind of felt natural to flow into that role as a personal trainer, would you say?
I think it felt natural in general, yeah. I think not just because I was a coach, but because the role that I've had within the region has been more of a, I don't think leadership's the right word, but like mentor, like elder type of, I guess, role. Where there is a certain level of respect being there before the ground floor even existed, right? Like building the foundations. So I think, you know, being able to then represent as a role model, I suppose, would be the best word. Is something that felt natural as a transition for me, right? Like go from being a player to someone who can still stay in esports to someone who wants to represent a holistic health.
Yeah, for sure. I love that mindset. I love that approach. You see it, especially nowadays, where a lot of gamers just have that kind of nulled in vision, that kind of mindset of just being in the game, but they're not addressing the external performance. So I love the fact that you're trying to tick those boxes. That's definitely an awesome thing to address. Let's take it back a step. So I remember, you know, opening League of Legends beta. I remember just jumping on Cybergamer, forming a team, the good old days, Twisted Tree Line on threes, running down bot with Gangplank, the old days. For those people who maybe weren't in that scene in the earlier days, what kind of experiences and, you know, how was the scene different back then?
I think realistically, the difference was that, like, very early, there was just no Riot in Oceania in its entirety. We were playing on the North American server, which is something that, if you haven't had to do it, congratulations. But, yeah, we got used to it. We had 150 ping on average, and we were trying to be professionals with distinct disadvantages. There was no real support thrown our way. In fact, there was a tournament that we entered, which was like an LCS qualifier. So to compete in the North American Professional League, we won the first round and then we got disqualified for being Australian. So there was never anything going our way back then. It was a raw, but like startup type of experience, you know, where like you really enjoy the vibe of paving the way yourself. Every positive step, you know, you've contributed to, you've been a part of it, and you've helped see it over the line. So that startup feeling was, you know, very significant for everyone there.
Yeah, for sure. And when you got into that league scene in the early days, did you ever envision yourself going, you know, internationally, going to Korea, doing these kind of things?
Oh, no. So when I first started, I was in high school with mates. That was why I played. There was a team of five of us. We all just decided to play at the time because it was a free game. You know, we thought we'd try it. Then there was just a tournament announced, and legitimately just coincidence that it happened to be on the Gold Coast. Yep. So I was never going to travel for this tournament unless it was like local and, you know, just happened upon it. We discovered, of course, that the winner goes to Korea, so that added some incentive for us. But like, it wasn't a thing we pursued until it was right at our doorstep. So we got very lucky. And managed to, you know, put the team together. Found someone who just moved back from Canada to the Gold Coast. Like, got real lucky on a lot of fronts, but you know, the goal was set and we hit it.
Hell yeah. It sounds really similar in my position, because I remember back in those old times we had Respawn LAN. There was a couple of lands down here in Melbourne. We formed a team to go. Didn't obviously kind of perform as well as we expected, but it's getting in, having that experience, you know, your first couple of lands. So I could definitely resent back and have those kind of mutual feelings. You know, after your time at Sequential, Mindfreak, Visceret, going into that head coach position, what was different from being a player? Obviously, you have that background, you have the game knowledge, you have all those pivotal things that allows you to, I guess, oversee some of the players, to have that kind of input into some of these guys. What was different and what was the mindset going into the coaching role?
When I first moved into the coaching role, just for a bit of context as well, I'd spent maybe 3 years shoutcasting professionally at the time, which was a factor. And I'd spent the last year in China working pretty actively with the teams and the whole region over there. So I did feel like you know, I brought a wealth of knowledge potentially and information and things that hadn't been considered. And I also believed that coming from a region where, you know, I'd been brought in on the aggressive style of League of Legends, coming back to a smaller region like Oceania, that should be even easier to do because you just need to be good at punishing stuff. So I came in with that mindset. And I really felt like when I was going to work with these players, I didn't know who my players were at the time. I was hired before I found my roster, which good. I wanted to build a roster that by the end of the year would just be like able to work autonomously. Because at the time, like while I was a head coach, I was still shoutcasting, and I was still doing other work. So I wanted to, you know, to build the wheel, help them make the car out of the wheel, and then just like push them off and just like make sure they stay on track. That was my goal. And I did quickly come to realize that in a smaller region like Oceania, the word head coach just means coach. So you don't really have the freedom of allowing the structure, you know, to sell itself or to like, you can't just build scaffold and let it go. You're actively involved and it suffers if you don't stay actively involved.
Gotcha. So in regards to that coach position, is that more so looking back at replays post scrims? Is that going over helping the players address their individual mindsets? You know, is that more so on a performance basis or more so the game knowledge basis?
It'd be a performance basis more than anything. Like your goal is to, again, like you want to make them good enough to be able to do most of the work themselves, because when they're in game, you can't speak to them. So they still need to know majority of the information. You're just ensuring that it's streamlined or delivered in a way that they can actually understand. So yeah, replay reviews, group discussions, group conversations, just, you know, leading them in the correct direction to achieve performance.
Yeah, for sure. I can only imagine what it was like back then, jumping in back to that scene, having that wealth of knowledge from China and, you know, from your shoutcasting days, and then being able to implement that game knowledge, but then also being able to address the external stuff as well from performance. That's fantastic. Can you see yourself jumping back into a coaching role anytime soon?
Yeah, I said this, like the day that I stopped coaching was that I enjoyed coaching a lot. My initial thoughts at the end of that year was that I wouldn't mind going to another region to continue coaching, just because I would like to experience not just being the head coach, but working with coaches or like working with an infrastructure opposed to being the infrastructure for the organization. And I think because I went from shoutcasting where it was established before me, so I got to just come in and do my own version of it, to going into the coaching where like what I was doing wasn't established, though coaching may be. What I was doing was completely new. I had new players. I was in a new organization and I hadn't done it before. So I would love to do that again, but in maybe a different environment.
Yeah, I guess going back and doing it again and then just kind of neglecting the things that didn't work, but then reinforcing the positive things that did go ahead and did work for the team.
Yeah, I think that's what I'd be looking at. Or at least, you know, being able to be taught new things that would make my job even better, just because I like haven't considered stuff, right? Again, it was so new to it in the first place.
Yeah, for sure. Having a previous chat with some sports psychs, you know, all those kind of people invested in the scene in regards to NA and EU league, one of the biggest things that comes across most often is the issue and the topic of team dynamics. So important, you know, how important is for developing your team, you know, dynamics, developing your team culture. Back on Avant, did you have a specific team culture that you guys kind of followed? Was it more so that mindset that everyone was kind of on board with everything, or was it more so, you know, everyone does their own thing?
We definitely had a culture as a team. It wasn't something that like I wrote down on the whiteboard as like the two words to live by type of culture. It wasn't the NFL coach mentality. It was just the idea first and foremost that the team decides most of the, like, we have to agree or we aren't going to succeed. And that means from the first day of the week when you come in and prepare for your opponents to the last minute of the game when you're fighting those opponents, you have to be able to be on the same page. Because the thing with, like, and this is a very important thing with Oceania, is it's not perfect. It is very far from perfect, though it aspires to be. You have to accept that reality, but do it as a team. because if you make a mistake, you still need four people backing you up so that mistake can be covered, or it just gets, you know, blown out of proportion. Suddenly you're losing games you should win. That continues through the week. That continues in prep, in play. And I think with that mentality of just like do it together and be aligned, you find more success. I think that was a big part of our culture. Being open, being honest, obviously are things that need to be a part of that, because with trust, you need those. But yeah, that was probably the biggest one.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. I've seen in previous my coaching roles in terms of StarCraft and Rocket League, that affirmation is a big one. So some players just want that positive affirmation. You know, they're going for a gank, they're going for a jungle, you know, whatever they're doing, they want their teammates to back them up. And I think that's one of the big ones that you see nowadays in regards to team culture and just developing those key communication skills that gives that affirmation. Interesting question now. Who do you think in regards to the LCO has the best team culture?
In the current LCO, so just for full clarity, it's 4 weeks old. the organizations have existed, but they've changed so much between seasons that to know what the culture is actually quite difficult to say. You could you could look at the winning teams and say that they very clearly have the best culture for the fact that they're winning, but at the same time, because everything's so new, it could just be the players, right? Or like the existing culture within the playing group, not the organization, that is the difference. So I do think that that's a like it's a very good question, but really hard to answer, honestly. Just because of how much has changed.
Yeah, for sure. It's one of those things, especially with roster rotations, that can sometimes throw off a team culture. For example, if we pick up a new player, how well are they going to be embedded within the team culture? Is the team culture going to be more so you have to adopt to what we think is proper? And if not, you can do a 180 and walk out the door. Or more so just, you know, bring in, be acceptance of that kind of mindset, so then we can try and bring out the best performance.
Yeah, and I think with esports in general, actually, there's not a lot of franchise players. So I think you can, like, have a culture, build a culture, and represent that through that franchise person, you know, like through the LeBron, for bad example, of your team. But because esports very rarely has that, like, can you really name one past Perks and Jerks and in other regions, Faker, there's Faker. Three that I've got. That's it. And that, consider that we've existed for 10 years, that's not a lot of franchise player. That does make it a lot harder to, you know, consistently keep culture.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. In regards to, I guess, touching on the topic of OC and OCN as a whole, what do you think we need to do more as a region to help make more consistent appearances at Worlds? Now, obviously, we had Legacy last year, fantastic performance. You know, is there a chance for another OCE team to, you know, go into Worlds next year or this year? What's the mindset there?
I mean, the good news is that we'll always be at the tournament. The question is always how well we look. The format has also changed for MSI. I'm not sure about Worlds, but we're like thrown straight into the mix against a lot of other teams. So it's quite difficult to say what my expectations are for performance. The things that we can do is attack the region in a way that, like, we have to acknowledge that we're improving, and we also have to be positive as viewers and fans of the fact that we are trying to be improving. And I think the fact that we go to an international and just get demolished by public perception is horrific to deal with. It's genuinely just really bad to deal with. And I mean, ultimately, we have a disadvantage of being able to speak English. If I'm going to be super blunt about that fact, right? Like, the fact that we speak English means that we are compared to every other English-speaking region in the world. It also means that they can all roast us and we'll understand it. Other regions, like, for example, Turkey, they might still get it really bad as well if they underperform at an international, but, like, they're siloed more, so there's definitely a lot more diehard fandom, which is something that I genuinely believe we need more of. We need more investment into the players, into the teams, into the region as fans to help incentivize performance and growth, because we need growth to have performance.
Yeah, for sure. In terms of, I guess, growth then, you know, is one of the biggest things that we have to try and tackle is resources, because obviously as a region, OC, it's very, you know, not on par with someone like EU or NA. Obviously, in, you know, those type of ranges, they have the tier one teams, they have the facilities, they have the external allied health professionals, that the sports psychs, sleep nutritionists, they tick all the boxes, right? But in regards to here in OCE, maybe we don't have as many of those facilities as options access to. So is it a matter of developing resources for some of those teams, or you know, how can we approach that?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, the players will be doing a lot of the work themselves, right? Like, yeah. They'll be trying to fill the roles of all of these people now. Sorry, that is extremely loud. That has gone. The role of allied health professionals is something that we can't replicate here in Oceania, which is one of the hardest things to replicate. But the point that I want to make, I guess, around this is there is a certain advantage that we have with time. And I don't think this is often discussed, but if we look at a game like CSGO, Australia's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, we've had a lot of decently performing teams, and I feel like that's steadily increased over time. Because we don't have the resources, we don't have the money, you know, we don't have the infrastructure that exists in these other regions, but eventually, because the game stagnates, you start to just rise, right? And as long as the dedication stays, you start to actually get there, because this isn't like Olympics performance athletics. This is something that, like, just click ahead with a mouse, anyone can do it. So I do think that time is an advantage that we actually have, but... The simple answer would be, yeah, we need more resources. We just need more resources.
And how much time do you think we have left before we really can't make that dent that we're trying to make?
So we are about 10 years in. I would say within the next 5 years, we'll start to like hit a big plateau. And my question or my concern is probably around where that plateau is, right? Have we caught up? Because League of Legends has stagnated, or like has the game, because Riot does like to do this, just completely shifted into this new thing. You know, suddenly lanes are swapped, everything's backwards, and we have to learn again, which keeps us down. So don't know.
I mean, I guess that kind of brings in the new topic of what would that happens if they bring out a new map? What kind of dynamics and, you know, kind of changes would that make?
The changes would be huge, first of all. In terms of understanding that there is 146 champions now, that those champions can buy like 200 items, and all of the interactions that they have is just like innumerable. And now we're on a different location. This isn't like your Overwatch or your CS maps, where there is five things that aren't variables with 12 weapons or whatever it may be. Like, this is ridiculous. So, a new map makes it very, very challenging to relearn and to know almost double, right, the information.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm going to play devil's advocate here, like an absolute sly dog. But what, say, happened, we introduce 6v6. We have two top, two bot, jungle and mid. How does that change the dynamics of the game?
I think you have to look at resources and efficiency for what it would mean to be 6v6. I think if Riot Games were to say tomorrow it's released, deal with it, the sixth role wouldn't be a top laner. I think he would be a river goblin that just like the way that it works, right? Experience, gold, all of that is so important that you can't just sit top lane and take experience, because then the jungler would be too strong, as there's double the lanes that have less experience than him, and mid laners would be too strong for the same reason. So instead you'd have someone just roaming being annoying, trying to take experience away, or there'd be two junglers and the game would just be garbage. So that's hard to do.
Yeah, for sure. It's going to be interesting to see where we end up in 5 years' time with League, because obviously in the previous last 5 years, we've had such exponential growth in esports, you know, bigger lands, bigger, more commitment, bigger stakeholders getting on board, more awareness to the scene as well, you know, not only in OCE, but obviously in NA and EU as well, and Korea and all those kind of Asian regions as well, more development for the scene. So it's definitely going to be interesting where we see, we're going to have a new game, we're going to have League 2.0. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, where we end up in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I do wonder if we'll get a League 2.0 in the future. I would imagine we're probably 10 years away from it, though. Just the way that, you know, Riot Games looks after the original League, It'd be hard-pressed to imagine that they'd put all this effort in consistently for this long and then just say, but here's number two, ignore one.
Yeah, gotcha. Another topic that I wanted to try and address is this kind of topic of tilting. So obviously, in regards to, you know, competing at that high level, at the elite level, tilting could be that one that can go in benefit of one team and in negative of another team. How can we try and address tilting so that it's more so, not affecting, your teammates' performance, more so just, one of those self-characteristic things. But is tilting sometimes good as well?
I think tilting is never good on the basis of what tilting is. Mm-hmm. I think that getting frustrated is fine, right?
Yep.
Tilting is, to me, the point of frustration where you've just lost all hope. Like, you're just off the deep end. There's no way back. Yep. So, I think you need to be able to be mindful and recognize when you're hitting that point where you're frustrated. Mm-hmm. And also recognize that I don't know exactly the resilience of all of our players right now, but there's clearly a low ceiling for hitting tilt where it seems like one thing could just like trigger it, gone, and that doesn't help that practice environments create toxicity or create tilt prone environments. So it does mean that realistically the players are more exposed to the negatives of League of Legends. Just because they see the same people multiple times, it's easier to get frustrations brewed over, and they're all random anonymous people that can say whatever they want and you can't. It's like, NBA training, going to pick up games at the park. Like, that's just dangerous in every way.
Yeah.
So regarding tilting, it's like the players just need to be so resilient. And that also means that they need a good outlet. So this is where, the lack of perhaps coaching staff is a significant factor for the players.
Yeah, for sure. I actually had a really good chat last night, actually, with a sports psych and mental performance coach from Canada. And he drew out this really good, nice conclusion that, when we tilt and when we try to, get toxic or try and blame ourselves, we should separate it into, one being the individual, so like myself, and then another person is my performance. So we're getting angry at our performance, but not the actual individual player. So it's important to have that mindset that on a team, especially, in that team environment, to get angry at another person's performance, but not directly as that player. Because if we start to get angry at the player, that's when they can start to have that kind of negative mindset and start to tilt as well. And that's where we can kind of collapse the bridge.
That's a really good way to look at it, actually, like separating the performance from the player. That definitely has use in a lot of ways for coaching, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess another kind of big topic is mental toughness. So, in regards to self-auto-regulation of emotions for some of these players, in a high-press situation, best of five or best of seven or even a best of three, it can really come down to the wire. And, one team fight can turn the odds. One team fight can, completely change the game. So, I guess, that development, for our league players to have that self-regulation to, understand that, yes, this happened. The game's not completely over yet. We can still turn it around. We can still wrap it around. I guess that's where we see some of the big underdogs showing out in some of the best performances.
Yeah, hitting reverse sweeps are things that you'd never expect to see, right? And you could often credit a lot of that to the coaching or the draft changes or, there could just be things that you can't see, the intangibles. And one of those is definitely mental toughness. This is like a conversation that I've had with someone who was a professional player in Oceania. They're now coaching over in North America. Their coach told them before the best of five series started that they are banned from yelling. So they're an emotional guy. He comes into the best of fives, he gets first blood, he will scream the house down, attacking, at the opponents because he knows they can hear him, right? He wants to get in their head.
Gotcha.
He loves that. Yeah. He was banned from yelling. Because that drains him, he would hit game two of the best of five, even if they won, and he's ready for a nap. And that is a factor within that, right? Like he's not mentally tough enough to be able to scream without the nap after a game or two.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of factors to that. Now imagine without the yelling, you've just lost the first two games. How do you have the resilience to even bounce back? Or you've won the first two games, but it was so nerve-wracking. You're on a stage that you're just cooked. Like there's no way out. So you start to make mistakes and they sniff that mistake and you're done for.
Yeah, for sure. I remember episode one of actually Mind Clickers, I had Udisoff on. So, previously from the Dire Wolf. So, and he talked about that continuous, especially in like a best of five, for example, that continuous ongoing cognitive fatigue. It just gets so borderline playing a 40-minute game, that kind of repetitiveness, and especially when it is, as you just said, so close down to the wire, And one thing can really tilt the odds. So it's important to, I guess, develop that. But how do we develop that? Is it more so having a performance coach on the side? Is it more so us players understanding, yes, it's going to happen. We've dealt with this before, so why can't we deal with it again in this situation?
A performance coach helps, but I actually don't know how vital they are, right, to still being able to train this, because I think that you can still train it to a certain point before the coach is ultimately necessary. If you're a player like in Oceania, you may not have full coaching staff. So you do this in practice, first of all. Like the training blocks are usually 5-game blocks. So you are trying to train in the environment where you'll be playing all 5 games regardless. And then you just have to be able to look at it from the outside in and say, was I making mistakes at a certain point? You know, so if you come into practice with the ideology that I want to not be fatigued, you know, I just want to be consistent for the whole block. That's a simple baseline way to attack it that players may not be actively thinking about, but they are actively doing. The other one is being able to, like, I mean, meditation is a way to do this, right? Mindfulness, self-awareness, being able to calm yourself down, all good factors, breathing techniques. If you're a bit of a Wim Hof fan, go for it. There's a lot of little things like that that you can do that I don't know are already done. I doubt are already done. I had one player that would meditate before best of fives. He would just spend 10 minutes in the corner by himself. We wouldn't bug him. There was other players that, you know, were super nervous and they'd start shaking and you just have a talk to them instead. You know, you'd pull them aside out of the group environment and just calm them down. But like those are the guys that maybe need to be learning how to auto-regulate, because I'm not there to calm down the nerves in game if they lose first blood to their opponents. So, you know, the aforementioned are things that they should be looking at.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be interesting how we go forward as a region in regards to that approach, especially if we don't have, I guess, the resources for performance coaches or, you know, any of these other external guys to come in and help. You know, is it down to the players? And one of the biggest things, of course, is the fact that entry into the elite level is getting younger and younger. So we have younger and younger pros, younger and younger guys coming into the scene. And obviously with these guys, they might be balance juggling study, they might be balance juggling uni, other work that they're doing as well. And that kind of stress is just going to compile. It's going to build. So, you know, how do we address those guys as well entering the scene?
Yeah, I mean, right now there's a bunch of 17-year-olds that have joined the league. And I can't imagine being 17 coming into a professional style league. And one, you know, being as nervous as I am and trying to perform on the stage, and two, copping flack for losing games and trying to be resilient enough to stick it out. So I that is probably the hardest thing for me now, because it's online, you know, there is less resources and it's kind of like the region isn't aspiring in the sense that it's more established. So these 17-year-olds are coming into something that they've known has existed for 7 odd years. I've always said that my DMs are open if anyone wants to, you know, get advice or chat. I've always been actively trying to advocate things like this, but you need those experienced players to help the younger players stay, right? Like, it's the responsibility of the ones that the 17-year-olds look up to not push them away, but to instead try and give them advice to help them stay on track, because you want them to stay if they're a competitor so that everyone improves.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess this kind of comes down to that mindset of, am I going to make it or am I not? And I guess it's that kind of uncertainty whether to go full send and invest into league, or whether to try and micromanage, you know, for example, after coming out of high school, you know, should I be, you know, taking 1 year to really focus on league, see if I make it or break it, or that kind of diversified mindset of going to uni or doing, you know, some other external study as well.
And Lost, who's now in the LCS, was someone who was in that position actually when he was over here. I remember having the conversation with him. Lost is lovely, lovely kid. At least it was at the time. I've spoken to him for a couple of years now. No idea what he is now. but he was very unsure about what to do. You know, he's an incredibly smart kid. His parents wanted him to go be a doctor, and he could. Once he's done, he could go be a doctor whenever he wants, really. Like, he's that smart. But he would have the conversation with not just me, but like, what do I do? What do you think I should do? Because like, my parents want this for me. Like, do I commit to what I love doing, which is playing League of Legends? And he did. He was already hooked, you know? And what I said to him was, would you regret not trying?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, you know, basically is one of the selling points for me as well. Like, you want these 17-year-olds to consider the full send and say, is it worth it? Can I move on knowing that I didn't even give it a go?
Yeah.
Is always worth considering. And something that the parents also, I think, should be more aware of is understanding that, you know, kids aren't always going to do what you expect or want them to do. And if they love playing the game and think they can make it professionally, give them 3 months or something, you know, like give them something.
A little bit of leverage room to help them try to understand where that path is for them or not.
Yes.
Sure. On the topic of that, you know, how many, I'm not too sure about the stats or, you know, the kind of how many we've had, but do you know how many people we've had from the OCE region actually, you know, transfer into NA or EU regions?
Oh, off the top of my head, I wouldn't be able to tell you an exact number, but we have probably five of them right now competing in the North American top tier one region. And we have maybe 10 in the tier two in North America. We have or had one go to the UK league as a player. We had another as a coach. We had someone go to the French league. So between, this is all between this year and last year, so 2020 to 2021 off season. So
dang,
that's why it's so hard to keep count. We've just had like mass exodus.
Yeah, for sure. And do you think that if these guys get the opportunity, it's something they should definitely consider, just because of the more, I guess, seriousness approach that, you know, these other regions take to league?
I mean, I think at the very least they should consider it seriously. Moving to other countries isn't always going to be as simple as you'd like, first of all.
Yeah.
Maybe not the current climate. It might be even harder.
Yeah.
So it can be a lot. If you've never lived out of home before, you need to consider how difficult living can be without support. So there's a lot to consider. But yeah, I mean, 100% take it serious. Like, you know, if you are thinking about it and you haven't moved out of home before, talk to your parents or family and just be like, I want to self-provide for 3 months at home and see how it goes. Like, you can help me a little. You know, just take a shot. But 100% consider it.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be interesting to see, you know, I guess, as the stats or, you know, how many people make their transition next year. It's definitely going to be really open. We had a brief chat before about periodization. And, you know, one of the biggest things I guess we can take is, you know, periodization is one of those big things that's really heavily invested in traditional sports. So we have periodization of training blocks, for example, I'm sure you're, very familiar with. But, you know, in regards to periodization of, I guess, esports and esports training, one of the biggest chats I had with was the previous Immortals coach. You know, this kind of idea of we can start to develop, you know, if right, would you, you know, sort of develop game-specific scenarios, for example, you know, you jump into a game, you know, your red's been taken straight away, you know, these super specific scenarios that we can start to adopt and practice and overcome. So then we develop that mindset and approach and know how to deal with them and how we can periodize that, for example. I think it'd be definitely something to really look, you know, interested in looking at.
Yeah, for sure. I think practice tool-wise, in general, there's a lot more that Riot could be doing for the professional scene. Considering that right now your options are 1v bot, like you can only really go in yourself if you want to like have sandbox mode to do whatever you want. You just don't have a lot of options. You can't 1v1 someone, which to like the very least, I think that's what they should put in next, right? Like the ability to play laning phase out in scenarios. You're 0-2 down, 30 CS down, it's a top lane, Cho'Gath versus Riven. Like, why can't I just instantly set that scenario up and then reset it if I make a mistake and talk about it?
Yeah.
Like, it's insane that that doesn't exist, just given that the tool is 90% there. I mean, to be able to periodize practice in on-rift performance stuff would be phenomenal. It's not something that I've actively considered just because it isn't there. Like, it'd be nice, but, like, it isn't there. And I also, at the time when I was a coach, wasn't aware of periodization and physical training or anything. So that was like, this is new information for me, like the last year or two. And I think I would have liked to have been able to incorporate that in some way, because it adds meaning to the year-long plan or the six-month plan, where it's easy to say we're not looking at next week or the week after, we're looking at the end of the split, we're looking at playoffs, you know, your traditional coach answers. But what does that mean for every coach could be different. And I think to actually have evidence-based, you know, periodization-based programs that you can alter as needed make significantly better if you can incorporate that into esports coaching.
Yeah, for sure. And that just, you know, sets the pace for more external research, I guess. What's most efficient in regards to periodization training styles? You know, what kind of time frame we're looking at in regards to periodization? And I guess that just kind of really can tick the boxes, because I think in Overwatch we have a workshop mode that allows you to kind of look at different specific situations. I know in StarCraft they have something very familiar. So I guess it's that kind of question of why. I mean, have they considered it? Is it one of those things that's on the talking blocks? So I think it would be beneficial for so many players, so many coaches, leagues. It would just tick all the boxes.
It's also, you know, this is one of the things that I think is important for Riot Games, is it needs to be good for everyone. And I still think it is, you know? It's a really cool scenario where you and your mates have been talking trash to each other. Go 1v1 them in the practice tool. Level 18, all items, you know? Who cares? Legit. Do it. So you can actually have the best mechanics. Vayne versus Vayne. Why not, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I guess it's, you know, even talking about those lower tier, like bronze, you know, all those kind of low leagues, they could heavily benefit from this as well, right? Just practicing those mechanics over and over again. And adopting those kind of, you know, styles.
And one-on-one coaching. Like, while I actively think about it, if I'm a performance coach for top lane, which, you know, the other regions that have resources do have, I can actually go into a 1v1 with my player and say, this exact scenario, this is how we play this out, instead of just saying it and hoping they get it, right? Like, instead of saying, go to solo queue, hope your opponents pick this champion, you've got your matchup 2 weeks later. Do you remember what I told you? That stuff is unrealistic, and it also means that like VOD reviewing could be easier for actual, like, for the kinesthetic learners, I suppose, would be the best way to approach that, because it's not all visual learners in the world.
The more we talk about it, it seems like, you know, it seems like such an obvious answer. I feel like we should just write the pledge and send tomorrow to him, mate.
Yeah, honestly, we need to pitch it immediately.
Legit, sounds so good. In regards to, I know you mentioned it very early in the episode, injury. So, you know, obviously one of the biggest ones in regards to esports athletes is that tendency to have that anterior dominance. So that slouching over, that hunched position, lower back pain, even maybe, you know, carpal tunnel injuries. What's the mindset there if we don't have the resources for external health professionals to come in and help these guys, you know, through these kind of hardships?
The mindset is always just about awareness. The problem with awareness for me, like education awareness, obviously very important to trying to prevent it, but they don't always consider. And like I was in the same position as these players, so I get it, right? Like when you're younger, you don't think that you're just going to like get carpal tunnel at 20. Like it's not a factor. And like then there's 18-year-olds that have it and have to wear wrist braces, and like that's the awareness that they needed for my players. It's like it shouldn't have to hit that point. Like there should be an understanding that the body is actively involved in the work that you're doing, just like every other piece of work that you do. And so you should be able to attack it in that perspective. But I've had players that, you know, will still get some slight, not injuries, but they're on the way, and I have to pull them up on it and be like, this is why you need to understand why. And that's coming from someone who actually has the experience, and not every coach will, because there's young coaches out there that are just performance. So there's a lot to consider there, and it's definitely not a catch-all right now in terms of solution for small regions.
Definitely. And I mean, what does it take to start that kind of talk, that consideration? Because obviously we can look to previous examples, Uzi, for example, you know, from the Asian leagues.
Yeah.
I think one of the quotes he said was, you know, I'm only 20 something, but I have the doctor said I have the arms and the, you know, the fatigue of a 50-year-old. That kind of just full send mindset to the game, to the sport, without kind of taking an hour, taking 10 minutes before a game just to stretch.
I would love for this to be an awareness that stems from the base level of parenting. You know, I do really think that. And this is, to be fair, like it's new, it's building more and more people are playing games in general, you know, like Fortnite was a massive boom for parents having to deal with every child that they've ever had wanting to play a video game. But if we go all the way to that base level, instead of saying you get 30 minutes a day of games or something, it should be like you can play games as long as you're not breaking your back with posture or Like, your wrists aren't, like, playing a controller like this the whole time. You're not a velociraptor.
Yeah.
That type of awareness stems from then a younger age, right? Which then builds into the mindset of the teenager that is playing professionally, because it should just be a known thing, right? Like, it feels weird that we come in at 17 and say, by the way, like, you've been sitting at a computer wrong your whole life, and for the 3 months that I'm with them hoping that it fixes, when I think that it stems well beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, we look traditional sports, for example, you know, parents taking their kids to soccer training, they're kind of ticking those boxes to ensuring that the kids aren't injured, getting checkups, you know, making sure that their gear's all good. So why can't we adopt that mindset into esports? It feels like it's just such an easy transition.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to us, people who are involved.
True.
I wish it was that easy for, you know, the average Joe here where I am in Australia to understand that, when I still get called Nintendo Boy to 27 because that's the only game console they know. You know, like, it's I wish it was that simple, but I think we're honestly like a generation away from even having that understanding, which is really tragic, because it just means you have to work harder as us, you know, the people actively involved to build that awareness and education.
Build the awareness. Yeah, it's definitely going to be interesting to see where we are in the next 5, 10, 15 years. That kind of mindset, whether the widespread adoption of more of a performance and well-being mindset has been, you know, scheduled into some of the players, and then, you know, the parents' mindset as well.
That'll be really crazy to have gamer kids, you know, like children that have come from expert or pro gamers. That'll be just weird to consider. Sorry.
One of the big things I've had a chat with a couple of pro players is this idea of adoption of exercise science in esports. So I know that in EU and NA, they're kind of adopting this as well, but, you know, potentially looking at heart rate tracking for some of their players. So, you know, chucking on a heart rate, seeing those kind of physiological factors during a team fight, for example, or even, you know, as soon as a team gets first blood. What's your thought about that?
I think that there is value in tracking physiological changes in general. One of the things that always stuck out to me when I was a pro player was, like, I spend more time looking at the minimap than I do the screen. And then as I started to get tired, which, you know, does bring back to the point of mental toughness and endurance, I start to look less at the minimap, more at my character. And I think that, you know, being able to track those things, so if it's like heart rate tracking for like how they are before the game as well, for nerves going into the game and where it spikes for them, and timings on those spikes is really interesting that you could work on. And eye tracking perhaps as well is something that, you know, was the first thing that I thought of when you brought this up as well, checking what they're looking at. 100% there's value in it, and as long as it gets used properly, right?
Yeah, for sure. Map awareness is one of those big ones, especially in something like League, StarCraft, something that you have to be actively focused on yourself, but then also your surroundings as well. So there's definitely, I think, there's a role for it as well. I had a previous chat with a sports psych, and he also mentioned that some players tend to hold their breath.
I guess
it's one of those ones that we can look at.
Yeah,
do you?
Yeah, I hold my breath and I forget to blink sometimes. It's like when I'm in a really intense team fight, it's terrifying to watch, but like there's just no movement on my face. Like
soul gazed direct
in. It's a 15-second window of, like, for me it's bracing, right? Like when I'm doing the heavy squats and everything, I have the 5 seconds of, like, slap yourself in the face, like full on, like full brace, and then just you're not breathing, you're holding. That's me in a team fight. So I translated to lifting well. Maybe not as useful in video games.
We're going to have to see where that goes. Just quickly, I was really just this whole while we're thinking about this, I was just thinking about your time in China, you spent in China. So do you want to tell us more about that, you know, what you did over there, you know, the whole mindset about going to China as well?
Yeah, I worked full-time as a shoutcaster over in China, in Shanghai, China. For an entire year, I was there just before Christmas, spent Christmas over there. I did the whole Orphans Christmas with a few friends that came over there with me. The rest of the team, when I say friends. We were there until about October of the next year. So pretty much, well, I was there till December, but close to a full year of working time spent over there. It was entirely shoutcasting. In terms of environmental shifts, it was wild. The weirdest thing to me is, like, and even looking back on it, it's still weird. The most familiar thing of that region was the esports broadcast. You know, like, yeah. I was familiar with only the players who were just all Chinese or Korean anyway. So my base level of comfort was just working while I was over there. I wasn't healthy for a lot of the time, just because I, like, if I wasn't working, I didn't know what to do. I was overwhelmed. I was in a foreign country and I was only here to work. Like, I wasn't here to travel. So I spent so much of my time just watching, being involved in, taking part in the LPL, the esports product that was there. Whenever I got to travel, it was awesome. I loved the country, actually. The food delivery just quietly is insane. Puts everything else to shame. You have no idea, man. It was phenomenal, but the gyms also weren't very good, as an aside.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
why were they so bad?
Fitness, it feels weird to say this, right? Fitness isn't a big thing in China for strength training, for the gym. Like, you've got your monsters. I think it's like Liu Xiaojun in the Olympics. He's a monster weightlifter. Like, it exists.
Yeah.
But it's more, from what I can tell, like, you know, martial arts, your Tai Chi, like, your other, like, they're active. Yeah. They're moving. Yeah. But the gyms, if they exist, are new. Or they don't exist in a lot of places. They're like hotel gyms, some actual gym chains. So it's brand new. I think it is growing, but, like, that was a significant factor for me and, like, feeling a bit out of place, you know? Like, the culture that I enjoyed separate to gaming just wasn't really a culture. It was just budding.
Dang. So over there, did you stay in, like, an Airbnb or, like, where'd you stay?
No, we lived full time, man. We rented.
Oh.
We had a full 3-bed apartment with two of my friends over there. It was awesome. We were in a really nice location in the middle of the city. 10-minute walk to the office. It was like, it was sick. The living arrangements were not the issue.
I was going to say, could you see yourself living there?
100%. Like, if I was to be told or offered even to go back to China, I would just say, give me 3 months to, like, just spend 3 months learning the language. Because that was everything, right? Like, I was lucky because one of my housemates lived and was born in Singapore. So he was very good at Mandarin anyway. So I survived. But without him, I think I was doomed. It was going to be horrible. So I would want to learn the language for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Gotcha. And I guess while you're there, because you had that such focus, you narrowed in on your work and your shoutcasting, did you see such an increase in your shoutcasting skills?
I think that was my best year of shoutcasting on record. I think that was my peak of ability to shoutcast. And it was unfortunate for me because I didn't get to go internationally as much that year as I would have obviously liked. I'd like to every year. But I didn't get the opportunity for Worlds, etc. Because I really felt like I was improving quickly and a lot. And I think by the time we hit the finals at the end of the year, I was like at my peak. I want to caveat this with a but because I think it's important, is my mental health was doing the opposite. So I put everything that I had into improving in shoutcasting and in that region, and I suffered everywhere else because I would just put 60, 70 hours a week into just that thing.
Wow. So do you find that the balance now, shoutcasting LCO, you have that kind of ability to, you know, go to the gym, do everything here back in Oss, and then you can still be involved in that shoutcasting circuit?
Yeah, I think that the LCO is kind of like the cherry on top in life in comparison to what it was like working full-time on the LPL. It's part-time, first of all, right? Like, I'm not working on the Oceanic League full-time. So I have much more freedom, right? Like, I can do training sessions with friends. I can do some PT work with friends or clients, of course. I can go to the gym myself every day, which is amazingly useful in a lot of things, including mental health. And then I just come in on Tuesday, Wednesdays, or Fridays, and I get to enjoy my time working on a product and trying to elevate it because I'm doing it because I care, right?
Yeah, for sure. I guess touching on that kind of shoutcasting momentum, what do you think makes an efficient shoutcaster? Is it the way that they can quickly articulate their words in a hyper situation? Is it the way they can paint the picture for the audience?
Shoutcasting is art, and that may not be a widely considered thing, but it is. Commentary, voice work is art. You would call singing art, right? I think this is a similar thing, but I'm not singing. I'm using my words. So I do think that to answer that question, everyone's different, and you need to find the style that is you. You need to find the style that everyone likes, because you've got people listening. I'm not just making art for myself, right? Like, I'm making it so that they're happy.
100%.
So there's a couple of things within that that to me are important. I also was studying primary teaching. I work with children. My strength is my ability to say complex things in simple ways. Like, I want to try and make it so that everyone understands the concept of weak side, you know, macro rotations, wave manipulation, in a way that everyone's like, oh, that checks out. What he's saying is just makes sense. Like, I'm not using big words to stifle anyone. So that's me. But for other people, it could just be coherence. For other people, it could just be energy. Like, I think Kobe is an excellent version of like a high energy. Like, I feel like I'm sitting on the couch with my best bro watching the football. Because he just gets me excited when the team's winning. But we're all very different.
Yeah, for sure. I remember having a chat with Matsy. So Matt Signor, really good shoutcaster as well for the Valorant. And he said that, you know, it's all about, like you said, it's an art. It's about developing your own style, because not every style is going to be, you know, plug and play. You know, different scenes, different audiences, you know, you might have to adjust that style depending on who you're shoutcasting for. The target audience can also sometimes be the biggest thing. But yeah, definitely agree. It's, you know, it's kind of that that art, and I respect that, man. I really do.
Yeah. I mean, I like that it is starting to, and I mean, other casters, I think, do feel the same way about it, right? I appreciate that is widely known as an art between the community of people that do it, because it's important, right, to understand that we are all different, because you don't want to come in as an aspiring caster and say, I want to be this person, right? You need to understand that what you're saying is, I want to take the good things that he does to make me a caster.
And stifling, you know, different motivations into future casters, I'm sure.
Hopefully.
Just turning off the gas down, rolling down the hill to the end. In regards to the future, what are we looking at? Are we looking at continuing shoutcasting? Are we looking at, you know, just, you know, having your edge in league, you know, going international? What's the mindset there?
The thing with esports is that every year is different. So if you would ask me what I want to do, I enjoy shoutcasting. So I would never be upset if I continue shoutcasting. I genuinely enjoy it. I love being able to provide the game for the players. I thought coaching was awesome, like we mentioned before, so definitely a possibility could be to return to that area. I also really enjoy fitness. I don't necessarily enjoy going to the gym and mindlessly helping train every, you know, random person, but I really, truly love the idea of helping those that followed my footsteps as a gamer to understand that there is mind and body connections, right? That there is so much more to it. So training, absolutely something that I'm still looking at. And I think maybe a combination of three is where I'm at, or it's just something completely different because it's esports and who knows.
I'm sure that many will be looking forward to see what happens. And, you know, as you said, it's unknown. It's one of those things where we're just going to have to wait and see. I'm going to put you on the spot here, Zach. Now, just imagine we've got 20-odd-year-old, 18-year-old, just pushing to plat, really trying to push to challenger, for example, really trying to get in there, get into a team. What kind of advice would you give to someone who's just, you know, by themselves, like treading through and looking for advice along the way?
To improve from platinum to challenger, usually if you can get to platinum, you have a baseline skill somewhere that is good. So you need to be able to recognize where you are good, but also recognize where you are weak to improve it. So generally the best way to do that is by VOD reviewing yourself and then comparing that to a pro player. So there is a million videos out there of pros specifically watching their point of view playing champions. Play the same champion, you know, like play it 10 times in a row, find a consistent baseline for your skill on it, and then compare that to the pro player. And you should be able to improve yourself enough to the point where you'll get to, you know, you'll get to diamond, you'll climb from there. And then you'll start to realize another issue, because now in diamond, everyone's better at warding or, you know, individual laning. And so you would tackle that one. So it's just understanding yourself. And if you cannot do that, do it through VODs until you can.
Yeah. Perfect. Fantastic. I'm sure that there's a couple of players listening who can definitely take that on board and keep that persistent mindset up. So I really appreciate that. Well, it's been a fantastic episode. We've touched on quite a few topics. The game specific scenarios has just been bugging me the whole time now that we've talked about it. Because I've just been thinking about, like, what if we could practice skill shots, for example?
Yeah.
It'd be so specific. It'd be so good. So I reckon we need to be on here. My video died. That's okay. So we've touched on, you know, League of Legends performance, you know, injury, periodization. We've touched on a whole wide of topics. So I really appreciate you jumping on today, Zach, and, you know, digging in and really exposing some of your previous insights into League as a player, as a coach, and as a shoutcaster. So I really appreciate that.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
No worries. And I will see you in the next one.